This is an I Am Listening original podcast.
Well, I think it feels like a challenge, and we've seen them in action a little bit so far, Reform UK, I mean, not just in the council chamber, but of course there's quite an intense induction programme where people are encouraged to ask questions and establish what they're doing, so you get an idea of what people are about and where they're coming from. So I think, if anything, is a feeling of determination and responsibility. It is a big majority they've got, they earned that majority, and now they need to perform, and if they don't, they'll be held to account by me and my colleagues.
Welcome to the Kent Politics Podcast, your go-to source for insightful discussions on local and national political matters. Join us as we take a deep dive into local government across the county. Find out what the key decision makers have to say, what your money is being spent on, and how the party's policies could affect how we live. Plus, don't miss our regular feature, Westminster Watch, where we dissect the latest developments and decisions shaping the political landscape in the heart of the UK's capital. Engage with us as we delve into the issues that matter to you and explore the dynamic world of politics from a Kent perspective.
Welcome to the Kent Politics Podcast. In the week we learned that Medway is finally set to reveal its local plan. Crown Commissioner Matthew Scott likened the increase in illegal waste dumpings to County Line's drug networks, and residents from a housing estate moved to have their management company stripped of its contract. I'm Simon Finley, local democracy reporter covering Kent County Council, and I'm joined by Dan Aston, who reports on the Kent's district and borough councils, and Robert Boddy, who reports on Medway Council.
Hello.
Hello.
And we're also joined by senior news editor Nikki White, who's been looking at what's been happening at Westminster.
Hello.
And this week's special guest is the recently elected County Councillor Stuart Heaver, who represents Whitstable West for the Green Party. Rob, what have you been looking at this week?
The long wait is nearly over for Medway's local plan. The draft version of the document, which decides where houses, employment land and infrastructure will go for the next 16 years or so, will be published next month on June 26th for a six-week consultation period where key stakeholders and the public can review and comment on the designs.
This has been a long time coming, hasn't it?
It has indeed. The last time Medway Council approved a local plan was back in 2003. They're supposed to last for about 15 years, but attempts to put in a new one in place since 2018 have not been successful, largely because of disagreements over how certain land should be designated.
Yeah. Are there any sort of bits of it that are particularly contentious?
There certainly are. The ones which will receive a lot of attention are Chatham Docks and whether that is designated for purely employment land or mixed use, meaning that it could be used for residential purposes. If it is mixed, the Save Chatham Docks campaign believe it will be a ticking clock before businesses are pushed off the land in favour of homes. The Hoo Peninsula will be another aspect which grabs a lot of attention. Complaints are already made about too much house building out there. So how much of the total allocation of the town's need for housing is placed on the peninsula will be very interesting. But it's also an area which has some significant infrastructure needs, both in terms of roads and GP surgeries and things like that, which many are hoping will be resolved here. Previous attempts at the local plan were halted by divisions inside the reigning political group, then the Tories. But whether Labour will face the same issue, either because they all agree with the plan or because they've all been brought into line, is yet to be seen.
All right, thanks, Robert. Dan, what have you been looking at this week?
I've actually been looking at the ins and outs of estate management with our new LDR colleague, Ollie Leader. Basically, residents of Springhead Parkway Estate in Ebbsfleet are looking to boot the management firm Firstport off of their estate.
What's led to that then?
So it started with a few residents querying their service charges, which they saw as exorbitant and unjustified, as anyone who lives on the estate with the management firm will probably sympathise with. And they said basically it didn't match the lack of maintenance they saw around the estate. Yeah, they say they were hit with surprise increases of hundreds of pounds just before Christmas on really tight deadlines to pay, and that communal facilities on the estate are a mess despite everything they pay to keep it in shipshape condition.
And how are they going to go about their plan to replace the managers?
So under the Leasehold Act of 2002, if more than 50% of leaseholders sign a petition calling for them to be replaced, they can exert what's called their right to manage and replace the existing management firm commissioned by the developers who build the estate. In this case, though, it's going to be a little bit difficult because they say Vistry, the developers who own their part of the estate, aren't being clear to them how many people they would need to sign their petition to initiate proceedings, but they are circulating a petition among other residents. And the local MP, Lauren Sullivan, has gotten involved on the side of residents. Firstport, they've got a bit of a troubled history recently, and in January, they were successfully overturned as the managers of the Faversham Lakes Estate at the other end of the county. So we'll wait to see what happens at the Springhead Parkway Estate, but not a very fun time to be Firstport.
So Simon, what have you been working on this week?
The Kent Police and Crown Commissioner, Matthew Scott, has described the growing practice of large-scale illegal fly-tipping or waste dumping as the new county line's crime menace. Illegal waste dumping is now so problematic that he sees it in the same way as drug dealing operations which run across county borders. And this you know, as most people will remember, has been exemplified by the problems at Hodeswood near Ashford, Brambletree Wharf in Medway, and also at East Church in Sheppey. But at Hodeswood, there were 30,000 tonnes of waste has been dumped on ancient woodland. So figures show that the scourge of illegal dumping, much of it is caused by these organised gangs using tipper lorries and transits, has jumped year on year in the county. So Matthew Scott, who's the commissioner, has called a summit of all the interested parties, including the fellow commissioners from Sussex, Surrey, Hampshire and Thames Valley, for a meeting on June the 3rd. The purpose of this is to share experiences and to discuss how better to manage the response to the activities of groups carrying out fly tipping all over the South East. Figures compiled by the County Land and Business Association, the CLA, show that in Kent, illegal dumping has gone up by 5% year on year. And just to illustrate a little bit, some of these individual areas saw the sort of bigger increases than the 5% headline. Maidstone, 19%, Medway, 14%, Tunbridge and Malling, 13%, and Canterbury, 13%, according to the CLA.
So what's the purpose of this summit?
Well, Mr. Scott says that the summit is about bringing together those who have the powers, like the Environment Agency and local councils, to see how they can work better together to tackle this criminality, because, as Mr. Scott says, tragically, the outcomes for fly tipping and waste crime are actually very low. He likens waste crime to County Line's drug dealing because of the scale and the fact that it doesn't respect any geographical boundaries. And we've also become familiar with waste dumping on farmland in Kent, and the CLA boss, Tim Bamford, who's also attending the summit, says the council has to act. When the criminals target farmland, the farmers have to pick up the tab because it's private land. And Mr. Bamford says the gangs are aware of the countryside is under police, and that's why they dump it there. He just said that, as Labour itself has pointed out, the crime rate in rural areas has surged by 32% in the last 14 years, faster than in urban areas. People, communities and businesses deserve to feel safe and protected, and the first place to start surely must be ending the chronic underfunding of rural police forces. That's what Mr. Bamford said. Nikki, what's been going on at Westminster this week?
So Parliament is in recess, and some MPs are using the break as an opportunity to get out and about a bit more, to find out what's good and perhaps what's not so good in their constituency. So it's been a mixed stuff going on. Sittingbourne and Sheppey MP Kevin McKenna, he's been out visiting Sheppey's Community Diagnostic Centre, while Weald MP Katie Lamb has been sharing asparagus recipes, giving farmers in her area a seasonal boost. And Dr. Lauren Sullivan, as well as championing the constituencies Dan talked about earlier, she's also been visiting a security specialist on her patch. But I'm going to take you back to last week, when Parliament was still in session, to highlight a speech Dartford MP Jim Dixon made about the dangers of bootleg alcohol.
Bootleg alcohol doesn't come up especially often. What's sparked this?
So Mr. Dixon has taken up the cause after lawyer Simone White, who used to go to Wilmington Grammar School for Girls in Dartford on his patch. She died of methanol poisoning after drinking free shots handed out at a backpackers hostel in Louth last year. Now, following her death, Simone's best friend and travel companion, Bethany Clark, she also became ill after drinking the alcohol. She launched a petition with the backing of Miss White's family, calling for the dangers of methanol poisoning to be put on the school curriculum in the UK.
So how's Jim Dixon got involved in this?
So Mr. Dixon was first contacted by Ms. White's family in November 2024, and he's now calling on the government to take the issue of young people drinking bootleg alcohol abroad more seriously after the 28-year-old's death. He took part in a debate in Parliament last week, where he raised the family's concerns around the dangers of this counterfeit alcohol abroad. He said he wants the government to take action and increase awareness, particularly among young people, on the likelihood of methanol poisoning. He said he thought the Foreign Office website should be very, very clear about the dangers in certain countries, and it should probably be doing more. And he and Simone's family and friends also think the subject should be added to the school curriculum, so it gives youngsters the chance to learn and also discuss the dangers.
Isn't there guidance already?
Yeah, there is, but after Simone's death, the Foreign Office updated its advice for UK nationals travelling to places like Laos, Cambodia, Indonesia, Thailand, Vietnam, Costa Rica, Fiji and Turkey, so all the places that backpackers go, to include a warning about the dangers of methanol poisoning. But Mr. Dixon says that advice needs to be far more prominent online, and he's still pushing for the subject to be added to the national curriculum for a high-profile campaign across the UK. He said it's particularly important for those who are 16 or older, because it's the time in teenagers' lives when they're just starting to think about their first trip out on their own after they've left school. Now, Sevenoaks MP Laura Trott and Orpington's Conservative MP Gareth Bacon, they've already joined Mr. Dixon in supporting Simone's family and the campaign, so you can expect to see some more from them in the coming months.
Okay, thank you, Nikki.
Is there a topic that you would like to be discussed on the Kent Politics Podcast? Perhaps you've got a question for one of our panel, or you'd like to comment on a hot topic in local or national government.
get in touch by emailing or sending a voice note to kentpoliticspodcast@thekmgroup.co.uk.
Such was the scale of Reform UK's victory in the KCC election earlier this month that you could be forgiven for not realising other parties as candidates elected too. The Green Party now has five councillors at County Hall, and one of whom is Stuart Heaver of Whitstable West, who joins us now. Welcome to the Kent Politics Podcast. Thanks for coming.
My pleasure.
So firstly, how did you come into politics and how did you end up representing Whitstable West?
I came into politics quite late in life, and I'm embarrassed to admit that I always had a slightly contemptuous attitude to local politics and local politicians. But it came to my front door, in the sense where I live in Whitstable is quite near the beach, near the Swale Estuary, and I loved swimming, sailing and being involved in maritime activities locally. And we had Southern Water and the sewage pollution scandal, and somebody put a note through my door with a picture of some Green Party volunteers in Wellington's testing the water quality, and it was the first time I'd ever seen a politician doing something rather than talking about it, and it kind of caught my attention, and I thought, well, if they're out there getting wet and cold, I'll go and help them. And that's how I got involved in the Green Party, which was only less than 3 years ago, and somehow I ended up being a councillor on Canterbury City Council and more recently at Kent County Council.
I understand, you know, obviously maybe the first time you've been a member of a political party, but you seem to have sort of lived around politics because you're what, a former writer and journalist?
Yeah, I've had many existences in my life. As a young man, I served in the Royal Navy, and they very kindly paid for my university education. I worked in business. I ran a business, a local business in Whitstable for many years, where I made many contacts and actually got quite frustrated by the local authority for reasons I won't go into all these years later. And then later got involved as a freelanced journalist and writer, wrote a book. So I've covered all those three bases in the course of my career, if you want to call it that.
You're one of not that many opposition members in County Hall and Maidstone, and one of only five Greens. How does it feel facing down, of all parties, a Reform UK administration?
Well, I think it feels like a challenge, and we've seen them in action a little bit so far, Reform UK, I mean, not just in the council chamber, but of course there's quite an intense induction programme where people are encouraged to ask questions and establish what they're doing. So you get an idea of what people are about and where they're coming from. So I think if anything, there's a feeling of determination and responsibility. It is a big majority they've got. They earned that majority and now they need to perform. And if they don't, they'll be held to account by me and my colleagues.
How did you feel about the behaviour of the Reform members on the first day of full council? There was a lot of clapping and cheering and walloping the desks and whatnot. And one or two of the older hands who've been in that chamber for quite some time felt that that was maybe sort of lacked a little bit of decorum. How did you feel about it? Or do you think that they had earned their right to gloat?
I'm not a fan of gloating or not being humble, but actually the honest answer is I'd never been to a full council meeting at KCC before, so I assumed that's what everybody did. We spoke about it afterwards, and I was actually surprised that when opposition members made, you know, valid points of criticism or held them to account, there wasn't more of sort of hearing and backslapping from our side. So you're quite right. I think some of the older hands were a little bit shocked, I wouldn't say offended, but a bit taken aback by what I think somebody said was a sort of, you know, barroom sort of approach to it all, but actually it was the first time I'd been there. I assume that was the form.
Yeah, somebody said it sounded more like a political rally than the sort of first day of a new term.
Yeah, I mean, I can understand the excitement. I mean, it was a big majority and good luck to them in that sense, but you expect your local politicians also to be humble and to be serious and to be professional, and hopefully they'll prove to be that.
John County Hall, another thing I want to ask, actually, the new Reform administration made quite a big deal of very symbolic matters in their first week or so in office, saying, you know, they're not going to fly the Ukraine flag, they're not going to fly the LGBT plus pride flag. You know, what do you make of that kind of thing? Do you think it's posturing? Do you think it's offensive? Or
I'm not really a fan of posturing and sort of petty token politics. I think, you know, this is local nitty-gritty stuff. We're there to represent our divisions. I'm very proud to represent Whitstable West, very proud that Whitstable West didn't choose Reform UK, and I'd like to be taking that responsibility very seriously. I don't think ripping down flags and making gestures really does anybody any credit at all. If anything, it just demonstrates or creates alarm and creates concern and anxiety amongst the people of my division that perhaps this council isn't representing everybody's interests and perhaps it has another agenda. But that's just concern on their part.
Well, I mean, you know, 57 seats out of 81, that's a hell of a number, as big as it's possibly getting, far bigger than ever even expected. I mean, why do you think Reform has become so successful, especially here in Kent?
Well, I know why it's not. But to answer your question, I think because people were hacked off. I mean, I knocked on a lot of doors. I did two election campaigns this year already, so I knocked on a lot of doors in my neck of the woods, in my manor, as you might say. Mm-hmm. And people were very, very cross. They felt they weren't being listened to. They felt that the key issues that they were concerned about in their area were being ignored. And they thought the politicians were saying the right thing to get elected and then completely ignoring their requests and completely valid concerns and just doing the bidding of the vested interest. So there was a lot of anger on the doorstep. Some of that we were able to tap into green success and green votes because we had actually not only concrete policies that addressed these things, but we also had track record of working on community projects all year round, not just sending people leaflets with our political leader on the front and asking them to vote for us, which is one way of going about things, but not the way we go about things.
Surely it stings a little bit as a Green in particular, because you know, Reform market themselves, you know, they're trying to turn net zero into a cultural war issue. They essentially position themselves as the precise opposite of the Green Party. And yet, you know, they're the ones who the polls are saying could command a majority in Parliament in the next election. They're the ones who are seen as the insurgent force, which is taking power and you know, disrupting the existing party system. And the Green Party, while it's, you know, been on the up in the past few years, is nowhere near as successful. Does that not give you sort of cause for concern for the success of the Green Party?
Well, yes and no. I remember knocking on somebody's door very early in the, actually in the city election campaign, a sort of gruff man of a certain age who was clearly pretty hacked off with anything. And we had everything. We had a really good constructive conversation. And I think we turned him round. I think I turned him round to be a Green voter. But he said, I'll tell you what, mate, he said, the next general election, I reckon it'll be between you, the Greens, Reform, because people have had enough of the mainstream parties. And at the time, I thought this was a pretty extreme view, and perhaps he'd been having a lunchtime drink or something. But as the election transpired, and then the second election transpired, then maybe he's nearer the truth than we thought. And it gives me concern, because obviously I'm a Green. I really believe in what we stand for and the policies we have about real local stuff that people care about, not just the environment, but actually the green economy, about how it can help people, help with jobs, housing that doesn't concrete over the whole of the Garden of England just to create luxury homes for luxury housing developers. So we think we've got the policies, but I take your point. I think if the Greens are going to be very successful in the next general election, we've got to get our messaging across in a rather more succinct and down-to-earth matter and try and destroy this illusion that I'm sure Reform UK don't mind elevating a little bit, that it's, you know, it's a sort of tree-hugging, sandal-wearing party, when clearly it's not. You know, we've got real concrete policies to make ordinary people's lives better.
So the new Reform UK administration at County Hill is going to be the last ever administration of Kent County Council. You know, in the next few years, Kent is going to be split up into, you know, three, maybe four unitary authorities, and local government as we know it is going to be completely reorganised. And you know, so technically both of the seats you hold on local government on KCC and Canterbury City Council are going to be abolished. What do you make of the local government reorganisation?
Well, I, like my Green Party colleagues, don't like it at all. I think it's moving power in the wrong direction. We believe in local people making decisions that affect their lives, and in general, the further down the feeding chain, if you like, you move those decisions, the more effective decisions you're likely to get. My own view is that the mayoral authorities will be a means of bypassing the inconvenience of local politicians scrutinising, and local politicians scrutinising planning applications in particular, so we just carry on with the housing agenda. So no, the Green Party, including me, are not in favour of this. And what I feel particularly uncomfortable about personally is that the LGR reforms were put through by the previous Conservative administration with not a great deal of consultation or discussion with the public. And I get quite a few emails from people saying, you know, what is this reorganisation? What does this mean? I mean, most people are confused enough by local politics as it is without reorganising the whole thing, without a clear plan, without a clear communication strategy. So no, I'm very worried about it, and I don't think we're going about it the right way at the moment.
You mentioned planning applications in particular, and obviously that's a massive priority of national government and is increasingly on the sort of national agenda. Frankly, the opponents of the Green Party paint the Greens as the party of NIMBYism, the party of no more houses here, go build them elsewhere. Do you think that caricature has any basis in reality?
No, I think it's a lot of rubbish. I think it's probably the only party with a consistent and coherent policy about housing, and this really applies to Kent, are the Greens. It's right homes, right prices, right place. What we need are high-density houses for young people to get on the housing ladder, for old people scaling down. What we don't want are more luxury housing estates built on greenfield sites and primary farmland. And this has been a Green policy for, well, all the time I've been in the party, but magically became a Reform policy 5 minutes before the last election. But we've been campaigning on this locally and in local councils for a long time now. So it's sensible policy, it's policy that people support, and it's policy that we can demonstrate we've been campaigning for over a number of years.
What a lot of people say is the position of the Green Party on many local housing developments, especially around Kent, which is you know, near uniform opposition, unless they meet extremely high environmental standards, whatever you think of those. That opposition to housing itself reinforces the poor quality of development which the Green Party opposes. You know, part of the reason why planning applications come forward that councils aren't happy with is because developers have to make money, like it or not, the state isn't in the business of building homes. And you know, developers build in a fashion which is affordable for them. So, I mean, you know, what do you think the solution is? Do you think, you know, the state should just be building, you know, vast numbers of homes, whether it makes or loses money, and the local people should decide where those go?
Ultimately, yes. I mean, that's a political choice, isn't it? And again, you're reciting the sort of consensus or the narrative from the mainstream parties we've had to listen to for so long. But this is democracy. We want to build houses, we can build houses. If we don't want to build houses, we don't have to build houses. What we have at the moment is the other extreme, which is a developer's charter. It's developers that are dictating where the houses are, where they're built. It's developers that are dictating to local authorities where these houses go, and are actually controlling the finance of local councils to some extent with S106 payments, so that councils become dependent on these payments to fund essential local services. So we've got ourselves in a real fix. And as one campaigner said to me, you know, yes, of course, we have a housing crisis. What we do not have is a luxury executive home crisis.
Another thing is on housing is that the new Labour government, which was elected merely on a low turnout with the very low proportion of the overall vote, but they won a very large majority for an explicit national mandate to build 1.5 million homes. They, you know, they made it a core plank of their messaging, and Labour MPs will now quite openly say, for example, Kevin McKenna, the Labour MP for Sittingbourne and Sheppey, part of his justification for calling in the huge, I think it was 8,000 home housing estate around the outside of Sittingbourne, is he said to me, the national government has a mandate to build these homes, and the mandate of a democratically elected national government has to surpass the mandate of local councillors elected by, in the grand scheme of things, a handful of people. Do you not think that's legitimate? Surely there is no legitimate democratic authority higher than the national state, and the people of this country voted for hundreds of thousands of homes, and they should get it, whatever local green councillors think of it.
You make it sound like an elected dictatorship.
That is famously what Lord Hailsham called the British constitutional system.
Well, yeah, but in fact, whilst it was Lord Hailsham's analysis of it, we actually live in a parliamentary democracy, and we have a whole tier of local government, so there isn't excessive centralised control of everything, which unfortunately is the way things are going. And I think there is a planning system set up so that local people can scrutinise local decisions and local planning authorities' decisions. And again, I think most people, I think, you know, it's just not the mood music. The mood I'm getting from people is people don't want this, regardless of what was in the Labour Party's manifesto. And there are a lot of things in the Labour Party manifesto that never saw the light of day. And indeed, they've reneged on completely, as people also know. But I think people do not want this. I think their concern is that it's the wrong sort of housing. It's the wrong scale of housing. It's not for local needs. It doesn't get homeless people off the streets. It doesn't get local young people on the housing ladder. I spoke to many, many people who have grown-up children living with them in their own homes, even though both these children, grown-up children, have good, well-paid jobs. You know, I have friends in Whitstable West that can't afford to even rent a house in Whitstable, never mind dream of buying one. So the housing market is completely screwed, and the Labour government has got it wrong, and people don't like it, and they will resist it until there's a change of thought.
Your party's actually currently having a leadership election. The new MP for, I think it's Bristol Central, Carla Denyer, the leader, is standing down, and the current deputy, Zach Polansky, is competing against the MP duo of Adrian Ramsey and Ellie Chowns to replace her. Do you have any particular dog in this fight? I'm guessing you've had some sort of involvement.
I've been a bit too busy with trying to get to grips with two councils than to take a massive interest, but I have to say I do have a bit of a preference, because I did meet Zach Polansky on a number of occasions. He actually did my campaign launch. It was on the beach, West Beach in Whitstable, when we started the KCC election campaign. I was very impressed by him. I was very impressed by his sort of authenticity and his ability to communicate. And again, I think you alluded to it in an earlier question, Dan, that if the Greens are going to compete successfully against Reform UK, we've got to get our messaging right. And we've got to make it clear to people that actually net zero isn't a cost, it's a benefit. If you live in a net zero house, ordinary working families pay zero heating bills unless it's in extreme cold, that the green economy in Kent is working much, much faster than anything that the Chancellor of the Exchequer and Westminster's come up with. So we've got to get these messages over in time for the next general election. For me, I think Zach could do a good job on that.
As I understand it, Zach Polansky is one of the only national politicians in the country, other than George Galloway, strangely enough, who's openly called for the UK to leave NATO, which, when we think of it, is quite a novel political position. Very few politicians will openly say they believe that, even if they do. Is that the kind of thing that you would support in foreign policy terms?
Well, I'm an ex-Royal Naval officer, so I'm not going to support Zach on that one.
The other thing you say is, you know, So Zach Polanski is definitely very strident in his messaging and the way he wants to position the Green Party. And you say that's the way the Green Party needs to compete with reform. Zach Polanski has described it as sort of eco-populism. But you not think maybe it's missing the sort of central policy issue, which is led to reform's popularity, which is immigration. They have a very firm line on immigration restriction, which is very, very popular, and that's why people support them. Whereas the Green Party's policy on immigration is, in the eyes of many, at best unclear and at least essentially extremely liberal.
Well, I think it's if people want to vote for a party whose only real concrete policy is to blame the problems of the United Kingdom, a very proud G7 nation, on the numbers and types of immigrants we have, then of course it's a democracy and that's their choice. I don't think that's correct. I'll campaign rigorously against it. It's my major motivation to campaign so hard in Whitstable West, and I don't see the Green Party ever condoning any type of anti-immigration rhetoric or policy. And I'll say tell you why, because when I knocked on doors in Whitstable, in relatively prosperous parts of Whitstable West, to be honest, I came across a number of families, one of whom both worked in the NHS, and they were scared. They were scared because they were scared that Reform UK might win in Whitstable West, and what that would mean for them, what that would mean for their children, whether their children would be abused at school, whether they'd be abused on the streets, whether they'd be spat at. And of course, people will say, of course, that's completely unfounded. That's never been part of anybody's political manifesto, but that's the reality. That's the reality. When you start talking about immigrants and immigration being a key problem for the United Kingdom, you're sanctioning lots of other activities which nobody, no patriotic Briton should be in favour of.
So what the solution is for national parties to simply not respond to very clear and apparent massive public interest in the issue of immigration?
Absolutely not. It should be absolutely out on the agenda and freely spoken about as we're speaking about it now. And what makes me really laugh about this is actually my brother's he's retired now, a senior immigration officer, and he's not party political at all. And he told me a number of times over a beer that the main problem or the main reason we have a problem with controlling the number of boat people, as they're called, refugees arriving on the shores of Dover and East Kent is called the Dublin Convention or the Treaty of Dublin, which was an intrinsic part of our membership of the EU, which gave member nations the legal right to return asylum seekers to their place or where they could first obtain safe asylum. That was destroyed and left when we left the EU. Now, the EU was left largely because of the campaigning of Nigel Farage and what was then UKIP, which is now Reform. So they created the problem and now pointed it as the main issue that's holding up the UK. So I just find that hypocritical and ridiculous.
Lastly, I wanted to ask you something about the support for the Green Party. So on the one hand, the Green Party seems to have many sort of activist foot soldiers and especially sort of online activist base and many of the people in the party who I would imagine are going to vote for Zach Polanski as leader who are disproportionately young, left-wing, quite radical relative to the existing main parties. But on the other hand, the actual voter base of the Greens at a local level is increasingly older, relatively wealthy, rural, disaffected, possible former Tory or Liberal Democrat voters. Do you think that means the future of the Green Party is in some way unsound? Because in many ways, those two coalitions have very different interests.
No, on the contrary, I think it's progressive. I think it's the future. I think people realise the green economy is the way to take this country forward. I think people realise that if we don't do something about climate change locally and internationally, we're all stuffed, frankly. And to talk about demographics, I think we're a really broad church. And again, from knocking on doors, where I had young, progressive, what you call left-wing idealist type people, very strongly supporting Greens, middle-aged, relatively well-off looking people supporting Greens, people from modest backgrounds supporting Greens. So I think there's a broad church we can tap into. And if I might say so, I think Reform UK would be a bit more worried because, again, my straw poll based on knocking on doors was most of their support seemed to be exclusively the over 60s and over 70s, white people in relatively affluent circumstances or struggling economically and looking for somebody, quite understandably, to blame for the problems.
Stuart Heaver, thank you very much for joining us.
This week, Reform UK leader Nigel Farage pledged to end the two-child benefit cap and reverse winter fuel allowance changes. Surely our Nigel isn't going all left-wing, is he? Or does he just want to be everyone's friend? Dan, is this a shrewd move or one that will ultimately backfire, do you think?
Well, I mean, his positioning on it is clearly political rather than one of sort of strongly held personal conviction. Also, I wouldn't say, mild public spending changes or increases do not constitute being on the left by any stretch of the imagination. I don't think it's a matter of personal belief either, because it's well known that on economic matters, he's very much Thatcherite, quite libertarian, and is generally of the opinion that if the state can avoid spending money on things, it should. What he is obviously trying to do is hold together the disparate wings of Reform's emerging coalition, which is on, you know, like most parties, its membership and activist base is overwhelmingly low middle class, and in Reform in particular, there's sort of predominance of small business owner types, but also a lot of, you know, they have very significant support among working class people who historically haven't voted or have voted for the Labour Party, people who are generally more sympathetic to a more generous welfare state. Yeah, so there's definitely a political constituency for, you know, a party which has very strict positions on immigration and also wants a relatively generous welfare state. Yeah, whether that will get Reform particularly far, or whether they, you know, enough of their members really believe it for that to become policy, I think is a different question.
But do you think that, you know, how difficult is that going to be able to straddle those two sort of belief systems? If you're you know, trying to be Labour on the one hand, and but you're trying to sort of on the other hand have that right wing sort of control on public spending and hacking back the role of the state. I mean, you can't do both, can you?
No, I mean, and you know, over the past 15 years, a lot of people on the left in particular like to think that the, you know, defining economic policy of the past 15, 20 years has been cutting of state spending, which it has been to an extent, but it's more about different things that the state does. You know, so public spending hasn't really significantly decreased in the last few years, even under governments which are nominally committed to austerity and reducing public debt and reducing public spending. Whether Nigel Farage and his party have any, you know, new novel Thatcherite ideas that have never been tried before, I don't quite know, but I'm not particularly faithful.
Okay. Rob, you know, Do the numbers stack up, the money?
Well, that's the thing. The thing that will be interesting about this is how this affects sort of the perception of Reform, because up until this point, they've really been able to play to everyone because they haven't had any really defined policies. These ones are the first that have come along where people can say, well, how much is this going to cost and where are you going to find that money? And yeah, Nigel Farage's answer seems to be cuts, and particularly cuts to things like net zero spending and things like that. Whether people are amenable to that sort of suggestion, or whether they just turn off at the idea of cuts because a lot of people don't like the idea of austerity and that sort of message, whether that will be the case, he's going to really lean on the idea of, well, we're cutting all the wasteful spending, DEI, these sorts of, you know, boondoggle spending.
Also asylum seekers hotels, which he says that's just simply not going to be the case anymore.
But in terms of...
because he said where he's going to put them, mind you, but...
Exactly. Well, that's the point. The headline figure of, you know, we're going to do this and we're going to pay for it by doing this, there are more questions which will be asked, and whether they will, Reform will stand up to that scrutiny, and probably more importantly, whether people will be listening to that scrutiny and taking in Nigel Farage's second answer is another point entirely.
Yeah, I think some of the experts are saying that the disparity between, you know, the promises and the actual reality is tens of billions of pounds, and they haven't come up with any kind of realistic plan for that.
Absolutely, and I think the lucky position for Reform is they can still play the, well, we haven't been in charge, we haven't let you down yet. I mean, they're not phrasing it in that way, but they will say, you know, Labour and Conservatives have promised you so much and they've not delivered, and they'll say, well, we're promising, give us a chance to deliver, and whether they get that gets them over the line will be another thing.
Yeah, Nigel Farage chose the week that Parliament was in recess to make this announcement. There are one or two aspects that kind of trouble you, don't they, Nikki?
Yeah, I mean, going back to the there was always going to be something in there about asylum seekers, and I don't know enough about the subject to wade in with an answer, but it is going to be interesting to see just how far he can get with that pledge to stop putting people up in hotels. I mean, the system is run by the Home Office, so any of the councils that Reform has control over, they're not going to have a say on the final decision. Well, they might have a say, but they're not going to make the final decision on as to what does or doesn't happen to those seeking asylum. Now, I know that our system is far from perfect, and we haven't got it right for everyone involved. But for me personally, it just leaves a nasty taste in my mouth that we're saying to genuine asylum seekers who have been through the most torrid and terrible life-threatening situations, we're just not going to help. It just will be interesting to see what happens if these hotels don't happen anymore. Where are they going to be? Where will they stay?
Well, I've often said that the best brains in Whitehall haven't managed to beat the people smuggling gangs in the last sort of 30 or 40 years. So what makes Nigel Farage any different to anybody else?
Well, we'll see.
We'll see, certainly. Okay. Okay, folks, that's your lot for this week. Next week, we'll be talking to Police and Crime Commissioner Matthew Scott about the findings of a special report into his position by Kent Online and the Local Democracy Reporting Service. Thanks to Rob, Dan and Nikki for their contributions. And don't forget to keep an eye on Kent Online for the latest politics coverage. You can also sign up to our politics briefing newsletter by visiting kentonline.co.uk/newsletters. And don't miss KMTV's politics show every Friday at 5 p.m. See you next time.
Thanks for listening to the Kent Politics Podcast. Don't forget to check out stories throughout the week on the politics page of Kent Online. And you can watch the Kent Politics Show on KMTV every Friday at 5 p.m. or on demand at kmtv.co.uk.
This has been an I Am Listening original podcast. For more information, head over to our website, im-listening.co.uk.